This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You'd be hard-pressed to go a day without hearing or seeing something about the presidential election this November. Historically, turnout is high. So why aren't local elections as magnetic to voters as the national races? That's one of the questions we have for Secretary of the State, Denise Merrill. She's in studio, and you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WMPR.org/where we live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Coming up later, we'll talk about efforts to combat Zika in Connecticut and the latest on why scientists are still struggling to understand the effects of this virus. And we'll also hear about life in the UK after the Brexit vote. First, I want to welcome Secretary of the State Denise Merrill to Where We Live. Thank you so much for coming in. So let's talk about Tuesday's race, first off. So there were 12 legislative districts up for election, state lawmaker seats. The turnout, to most people, didn't look very high. What was it, 19% for Dems, 17% for registered Republicans? How did that race compare to others?
Yeah, believe it or not, that's slightly higher than what we thought would happen because it was a unique election in the sense that there was no statewide primary for any of the federal offices. So, you know, it was a few towns had primaries, basically. And those towns, it could have been a Republican primary in some cases or a Democratic primary in other cases. So it's a very limited audience, first of all. But 20% was actually pretty decent. And, of course, these are unofficial results. Sometimes that changes in the next few weeks. But, that's a sad statement, isn't it?
It is.
20% does not sound high.
We heard some sentiment from listeners via Twitter that, you know, they had no idea that there were these local races. So, you know, where does the buck stop? Should there be more, announcements from your office? Should be the local officials in town, if there's an election coming up, should they be getting the word out?
We all do. I mean, I put out numerous statements on every media I could find. We always do for every election. You know, some of it is because there is very little local media anymore. I mean, everybody knows what Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump had for breakfast, but they don't know about their local candidates. And some of that is just it's a presidential year. All the attention is going nationally. And, you know, it's sad because local candidates are where you can really make a difference. You know, no one's going to notice, you know, if you're voting for president. I'm not sure that will give you access to a president, but locally, these are folks you see in your grocery store.
WMPR's Colin McEnroe spoke about how he ran into some problems at his polling site. Here's what he had to say on WMPR's Wheelhouse on Wednesday.
So, I went to what's a new polling place for me. I got turned away. I was told I was not on the list. I went home. I thought about this a while. And actually, when I was there the first time, I said, you know, I'm pretty sure I got something in the mail telling me I really had been reassigned to this. And one of the, I think it might have been the moderator there, said, well, no, you would have had to go to town hall for that or whatever. So I sort of gave up, and then I went home. And then I thought about it some more. And I even located the piece of paper. It comes from DMV. It's because I re-registered my license. It says, no, this is where you vote right now. So I go back, and this time they find me on the list. And I just, you know, these are nice people. And they're volunteers for the most part. Or people are giving they're donating their time. They're not evil people. This wasn't a voter suppression tactic. It wasn't anything like that. But it's too damn hard to vote in Connecticut. There's too much confusion about what the rules are, the rules about photo IDs. I mean, we know from these Texas cases, photo IDs are evil. But you will always be asked for a photo ID when you vote in Connecticut. And from the Secretary of State's office, you can see what the rules are. The rules are unbelievably confusing and unnecessarily confusing.
So, Denise Merrill, again, Connecticut Secretary of the State. You know, what's your reaction? I mean, you're nodding your head when Colin says that elections are too damn hard here in Connecticut. What are some ways to make it easy?
Oh, we've been working on this a long time. And as I have said on Colin's show, I think the biggest problem we have on Election Day is people show up at the polls and they're told their name isn't on the list for whatever reason. And it's usually either a clerical error or they moved and didn't change their registration. And a lot of people just figure it follows them, which it doesn't, and it should. And I think we're making progress on this because, you know, this new and we're going to talk about this in a little while. DMV now will be a place where you can register to vote and get your license renewal. That's a step forward because at least you only have to go to one place to get something done. But yes, it's the biggest problem we have. Personally, I think with a statewide voter list, we ought to be able to vote in multiple jurisdictions, for example, as they can in many states. You know, there's no reason anymore that you have to have very, very local places. In fact, if you move from one side of town to the other, sometimes you have to re-register. I mean, that's no longer necessary.
We were talking before the show about November. And so when we look at the turnout in August, again, historically, presidential races, it's pretty high. You know, what kind of training will your local registrars and their volunteers slash staff get to make sure that these people aren't going to be running into the same problems where their name isn't on a list? What do they do?
Yeah. Well, of course, it's better during a general election because we have election day registration. So if you get to a polling place and they say, oh, you're not on the list, you can fix that. You have to go to town hall to do it. Mm-hmm. So far, we still haven't got internet at the polls, but at least it can be rectified, but not in a primary. Primaries are different. It's interesting to think about what the turnout's going to be for the presidential, but we're figuring it'll be high. But our elections are hyper-local. Every registrar in the towns, they're responsible for training and hiring and making sure the polls are opening. And so it's very difficult. We have now created standards for the first time for training and certification of registrars, and that just went into effect last year. And so now I think things will be more orderly. I hope so, because we have put some things in place that hopefully that kind of thing won't happen as much.
You mentioned Motor Voter. So just this week it launched this, I guess, new process. I guess you could always register at the DMV, and now and now there is an official prompt to the clerk. So if you go there to register your car or get a driver's license or renew, there's actually a prompt that they're going to ask you. Can you explain that process?
Yes, sure. Actually, since 1993, there was something called the Motor Voter Act passed, and we were supposed to be doing this all that time. We haven't been doing a very good job with it, primarily because of the training aspect. They just, you know, it fell between the cracks over the years. I don't think we ever did a very good job. But it was brought to my attention a couple of years ago that Connecticut wasn't performing well. Many states, most of their registrations come from the DMV through this process. And basically what it is you get up, you're after standing in line, presumably. We won't go there. And then you're, let's say, getting a new driver's license or renewing your driver's license. The clerk, it's all on computer now, of course. And so after the clerk takes your name and address and whatever information they collect for your driver's license, there is a prompt for the clerk to say, and by the way, would you like to register to vote? And if you say yes, they will have a kind of pre-populated form with your name and address all spelled correctly, theoretically. See, that's one of the big problems we have with voter lists. Mm-hmm. People are trying to read people's handwriting. They get it wrong. They're in the wrong place, that sort of thing. So this will fix all that because it's already filled in. They give it to you, a piece of paper. You fill in whether you want to register with a party. You attest that you're a citizen, all the things people are concerned about. And you give it back to the clerk. The clerk then inputs it into the computer and sends it electronically to the towns where it's processed. See, it's still a very local process. So each town has to process that piece of paper. But the DMV no longer has to do it all by hand, which is what they were doing before, which is probably why it wasn't happening very much.
And so it launched actually in the AAA offices Monday and the DMV Tuesday. How many people are taking advantage of this?
Hundreds. And this is what's really interesting because at the time we predicted that if we automated this process more readily for people, that it would result in more registrations. And I think it's starting to look like that's going to be true because in the very first day on Monday, when DMV is closed, of course, AAA is open and they processed 153 new voters just on that first day. Tuesday, when DMV opened, they processed 541 new voters and 689 changes of address, which gets me all excited because that means, hey, we're going to have more accurate lists. So that's a huge number. Normally, we were trying to figure out like how many we usually get in a year, and it's about 100 a day total overall, not just DMV, all registrations. And here we have 541 new voters on the first day of the operation. It's great.
I'm talking with Connecticut Secretary of the State, Denise Merrill. We were talking about the Motor Voter Act and how now when you go to the DMV or the AAA, you're able to register to vote. And it seems like an easier process. in terms of the question about citizenship, we know here in Connecticut we do have a program where people that are undocumented can go and get a driver's license. And so what is the process for someone who may not be eligible to vote if they were then asked, you know, do you want to register to vote? If they're not eligible, what are the checks and balances?
Well, at DMV, the whole non-eligible driver's licenses are a separate system, so they don't intersect. So once someone says they're eligible to vote, if they're there to get a separate license, as that kind is, then they would not be allowed to register, first of all. And, of course, there are many other – I mean, the fact is people attest to the fact they're a citizen, so you have to sign something saying you're a citizen. So I think there are a lot of checks and balances. And then, of course, it goes to the local level where they also check to make sure you actually live there and that sort of thing. So I don't have many concerns about that.
I want to take a call now. Jeff from Prospect. Jeff, you're on Where We Live.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling – my question is, I know – obviously, that it seems like there's progress here with the motor voter registration, although that seems like it's probably around in many states. My question is for not to get rid of the paper ballots or the voting stations, because I know a lot of people that are not computer savvy really like that history. However, why can't we, for local elections at least, have a internet voting plan? The concern that everybody, you know, puts out is the concern that there might be voter fraud or some sort of thing like that. But I don't know whether that's such a concern when we're talking about local elections and the capacity to hack into a computer system for local elections. What are your thoughts?
All right. Thank you, Jeff, for your call.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up because there has been a lot of discussion just recently about the security of our elections. We have been very resistant to any kind of internet voting. There have been people that have demonstrated that you can hack into certain machines. Personally, I am very dubious that anyone could ever, quote, hack a national election. But the question about a local election is interesting. I do still feel that the paper trail is important because if there are ever questions, a close election, even at the local level, you always have that paper trail. And I think in the future perhaps there will be internet voting, but they're going to have to improve the security. And right now our problem is we have older technology, even our scan machines, which frankly I love. I think they're great because they are older. They're just a scanner, but you still have a computer chip in there that tells the scanner how to read the ballots. And so, but I think this idea that you have a piece of paper that you can trace and go back to is very important, along with our post-election audits, which we also audit all the machines. So, you know, it would be a hard sell with me.
You had said that you think you're dubious of a national hack, of a national race. Why is that?
I think it's actually kind of laughably impossible because of just what we were discussing before. There are, you know, thousands and thousands of precincts in this country, and every state does it differently. Every jurisdiction has different equipment. Most of the country now has the scanners as we do, which has a paper trail, and you can trace back to make sure that the results have not been tampered with. Individual machines, probably if given enough access, you could probably hack into the little card and tell it to do something different. But that would be so difficult to orchestrate on any massive level that I just can't even imagine it.
So if we had one system for the whole country, a national system, take the states out of it, that would be an easier way to hack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. See, but we just don't have that in this country. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us moan about it all the time. But truthfully, in the end, I'm beginning to think it's not a bad thing.
Let's talk about election performance in Connecticut. So there was a Pew study earlier this week. Connecticut's rated pretty highly.
Yes. We're up to number 5 in the country, which is quite great for us. I mean, it's an interesting index. They rate the states on 17 measures of election performance, and it includes things like data management, you know, how much we're reporting, is it accurate? But it also includes things like, you know, have we reduced barriers to voting? How easy is it to vote? What's the voter's experience? So they measure things like time in line, and that's all kind of self-reported. So they use survey data from various sources and federal and local elections information. So for us to come up, we came up from, I think we were 19th in 2008. So we've come a long ways, and we have done a lot to change things and make it better.
I'm getting a call now. Luther from Glastonbury, he's referencing the Pew study. Luther, you're on Where We Live.
Hi, Luther Weeks, Executive Director of the Connecticut Citizen Election Audit. And I agree with many of the things the Secretary has said, but I'm always skeptical of things like a performance index that look at just a few items, you know, sort of like one business survey says Connecticut's the worst place for business, and the next one says, oh, we're really good for business. And I just bring up a couple of things. You know, as reported in the paper, our SEC is being crippled. We have a very slow process for resolving election complaints. And, you know, our group did a study of websites in Connecticut, and the local websites, just a little over half of them have no link to online voter registration. Only 15% of them tell voters about the voter ID requirements so they come to the polls prepared. So there's a lot of things that we could do better. And I just add one more thing for election preparedness. It's good that we have Election Day registration, but that Election Day registration is totally dependent on the phone system working, the state voter registration system being up and online all the time. I'm worried about a November that comes like we had with Hurricane Sandy, and where the voter registration system goes down, as it does occasionally, and we're stuck in the water in being able to do Election Day registration.
All right. Well, thank you, Luther. I'm going to have Secretary of the State Denise Merrill answer some of your concerns, starting with election complaints. What is the process?
Yes, that we are not – my office does not handle complaints. It is, as Luther says, and hello, Luther. Thank you for calling in. It is the Election Enforcement Commission. It's a difficult situation because elections are momentary, and of course, to try to investigate any complaints that come in on the spot is very difficult. So it's usually after the fact. And we have an Election Day hotline, which we staff with the Election Enforcement Commission, and we try to go and at least find out of the thousands of complaints that might come in on an election day, which ones are real, which ones are just like candidates and campaigns roiling the waters. There's a lot that goes on. So, you know, I don't know if we could do any better. And I know there's been a lot of complaints about the funding for the Election Enforcement Commission. I'm not sure that would make any difference. It's just how it is. Elections are a moment in time and everyone's very head up.
We just have a couple more minutes. I wanted to just read a comment from Adrian from Norwich. We may not have time to take your call, Adrian. But Adrian's asking, how do you outreach to the elderly and disabled? Who should we contact to try to have someone speak to that particular population?
Yes, actually, there's a lot going on. We're hoping to have new disability voting machines in place by this election. So, again, it's your local town that really runs these elections. So it's your local town clerks and registrars that would be the people to talk to about exactly how people can access these. But I speak all the time to senior citizen groups and the disabled community about these issues. So I'm happy to come wherever people would like me to come talk about it.
And then real quick, we were, again, speaking about the national race, the presidential race happening in November. Again, what is high turnout and what do you see happening with people who find both candidates not very palatable?
Boy, that's the $64,000 question lately, and I'm not sure. I don't even know myself, but I can just tell you that a high turnout or an average like presidential turnout in Connecticut is around probably 70% would be on the high side. I don't know. It depends on whether, for example, we have some third-party candidates that get onto Connecticut's ballot, which we'll find out in a week or so whether the Green Party and Libertarian, for example, candidates are on the ballot. And, you know, everyone you talk to seems confused. So, you know, if we hit, I'm expecting it to be a high turnout. There's just so much interest in this election. I can't imagine there's that many people that want to sit it out.
I want to thank Denise Merrill, Connecticut Secretary of the State. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll have to have you back on again before November.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about.
Coming up next, we'll find out more about efforts to combat Zika in Connecticut. Local transmissions of the mosquito-borne virus are a big problem in Florida. Could we see that kind of outbreak up here? This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Zika, 1,600 cases have been confirmed in the continental U.S., primarily in southern states. But one of the mosquitoes that can carry the virus lives in Connecticut. Today, we're checking in on efforts to combat Zika locally after news that the federal government has allocated millions to states. However, some lawmakers, among others, argue this batch of federal money is not enough. In studio with me now is Dr. Ted Andriotis, director of the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. Dr. Andriotis, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're going to start with you. Again, this batch of money has come into Connecticut. Is it about $1 million?
I think that's right. For the experiment station, we're going to receive another $100,000 that will help us enhance our mosquito trapping and testing program. We have a very comprehensive program that dates back to 1997 where we monitor mosquito populations throughout the state of Connecticut in 91 locations. We collect starting in June and continue until the end of October. What this additional funding will allow us to do will be enhanced trapping and testing for the Zika virus. As you indicated, we do have one species of mosquito here in Connecticut called the Asian tiger mosquito that's really located just along the coast in Fairfield and New Haven counties. And we're collecting more of those mosquitoes and testing them specifically for the Zika virus. Right now, all indications are that while this mosquito is capable of transmitting the virus, it is not the principal species that's driving the epidemic in Central and South America, nor is it the species that's involved in local transmission in South Florida right now. That species is called Aedes aegypti. It's a tropical species, and it does not occur in Connecticut, and we're not likely to see it. So we're operating under the assumption that we're not likely to see the virus picked up by local mosquito populations, but we are clearly trapping for it and testing for it. And thus far, none of the mosquitoes that we've trapped and tested, and we've trapped over 120,000 to date, have tested positive for Zika.
I'm reading here that an extra $100,000 was given to the ag station from the CDC. And so is that enough to have you do this extra monitoring, even though, your staff has been trapping mosquitoes, testing for other viruses in past years?
Yes, this will really help. We've got one other problem because our state funding for the mosquito program had been cut by about $50,000. So this will help to bridge that gap. In addition to that, we need to purchase specialized traps. It may be hard to believe, but we have 50 different species in Connecticut, and they're not all the same. And this particular mosquito does not go into the common traps that we use to monitor West Nile virus and eastern equine encephalitis. So we have to use a specialized trap. So with this additional funding, we can purchase these traps, we can trap more frequently, and we can conduct the testing in our biosafety level 3 containment facility for the Zika virus. So that's what that funding will be used for.
Can we talk a little bit about the testing? How is there anything different about the way you've tested for other mosquitoes for this particular one that you say is found in the southern part of the state?
No, the procedures are generally the same. What happens is we collect mosquitoes every day. They come into our laboratories in New Haven. We identify them all microscopically, and then the following day they go into our biosafety level 3 containment facility where we grind them up and we put them into a cell culture. And we use African green monkey cells, if you can believe that, because these viruses will grow. And if there's virus in the mosquitoes, we start to see what's called cytopathic effect, where the cells become disruptive. Then we have to make a decision what to test for. And we were able to test by molecular techniques using PCR for 7 different viruses that we know occur in the state, as well now as the Zika virus. So that's the procedure that we generally use. And our turnaround time is quite quick, usually about 5 to 6 days before we collect the mosquitoes and we can report the results that go directly to our Department of Public Health, which will then inform the local communities.
That's Dr. Ted Andriotis, director of the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. Joining us now in studio is our State Department of Public Health Commissioner, Raul Pino. Thank you so much for coming to Where We Live today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So Zika is on the minds of a lot of people, not just abroad, but here locally with the number of transmissions, the cases that have been confirmed in Florida. What can you tell us about Zika here in Connecticut?
Well, at this point, we don't have a major concern or expecting local transmission in Connecticut, but it doesn't mean that we are not alert and looking for it. So we have designed several layers in our surveillance system that will provide us with the ability to quickly identify cases that may happen in Connecticut if they happen, so that we will be able to react and act accordingly.
Can you talk about the process to test people, whether they have been coming back to Connecticut from abroad? I heard there was something called sentinel testing.
Yes, there are 2 different systems in place right now in Connecticut, and it changed. It's changing. Yeah, this is a changing environment as we learn about this disease and what can cause. So if someone has developed symptoms, either male or female, and there is an indication that they have trouble or being in contact with someone who have trouble in the last 2 weeks to some of the affected areas, they will be tested.
What are the symptoms?
The symptoms are, you know, the normal symptoms that you see in any flu-like disease, except that this one normally present with a skin rash and conjunctivitis at times. So muscle ache, headaches, fever, being tired, that kind of general feeling that people get when they are sick.
And how many people have been tested here in Connecticut? How many confirmed cases?
So we have tested up to today or to yesterday, 519 individuals. 390 of those were pregnant women.
And so when you talk about the sentinel testing, what is the criteria? So if they have traveled abroad, if they're pregnant, and they have certain symptoms?
Maybe? Well, the sentinel system is designed to go beyond what is recommended by the CDC. So in coordination with our cultural station, we have identified areas that if we were to have local transmission, is more likely to happen. Because who live in those areas, meaning what ethnic group live there that are connected to the areas where transmission is happening. Also, there's areas where the mosquito, the albopictus, has been found in the past. So if we were to have a mosquito transmission, if we have of the conditions, those are some of the places that are more likely it could happen.
So Bridgeport along the shore?
Yes, along the shore. We are engaging more facilities step by step. So basically what we do is we said to the doctors in those locations, you can test out of the range up to 10 individuals per site that have any of the symptoms that are related to Zika, even if they don't have a history of traveling to the area. And that's what we are looking for. So right now we are engaged with St. Vincent and all the facilities, Southwest Community Health Centers, and Optimus Healthcare.
So what we know is that you can possibly get Zika from being bit by a particular mosquito or sexually transmission?
Yes. There has been sexually transmission already in the United States, as well as what is believed to be mosquito-to-human transmission in Florida.
And you talked about populations. Obviously, lots of Puerto Ricans live in Connecticut. Many go back and forth. In Puerto Rico, a big explosion of Zika there. So is it likely that we would see people, when you look at the people that have been confirmed, that they have traveled?
Well, interesting. We were expecting that. Okay. It looks like, Puerto Rico is having an outbreak right now. I mean, it's going a little bit higher than it was a few weeks ago. But most of our cases are coming from the Dominican Republic. Interesting enough, we were not expecting that. It may be that some of the measures that we have taken into place and that Puerto Rico has put into place are working at this point. But still, it's early in the season for Puerto Rico. Our summer is very short. So we'll see what happened.
What kind of guidance are Connecticut residents being given? Are there signs at the airport or reminding people that if you're traveling to a particular part of Latin America, the Caribbean, just to be wary when you come back if you notice you're not feeling well? You know, what's the advice you give to our residents?
So you mentioned the airport. So at the airport, we have developed a campaign that is designed specifically for the flights that go to Puerto Rico. Other areas, people fly from New York or Miami or do other connecting flights, so it's almost impossible for those areas. But at least for the flights that we have daily to Puerto Rico, there is an advertisement at the airport that each individual who is departing Connecticut receive a flyer with information on how to protect themselves. And we have campaigns in Spanish and English that are targeting our most at-risk population that travel to different areas.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking about Zika preventative efforts here in Connecticut. Commissioner Dr. Raul Pino from the Connecticut Department of Public Health is here. Also, Dr. Ted Andriotis, director of the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. If you have a question, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. A lot of attention on the amount of money that the federal government is giving states and whether it's enough. And joining us now is Dr. Paolo Verardi, associate professor at the University of Connecticut. You're doing important work, Dr. Verardi, trying to develop a vaccine.
Absolutely. I am actually a native from Brazil, so I was aware of the Zika outbreak very early on. And once we realized, the microcephaly cases, the spike in microcephaly cases, I started immediately working on a Zika vaccine myself, and also in conjunction with two other vaccine companies here in Connecticut, Protein Sciences and Carrigen. So we are in the process of developing our vaccine candidates and testing them.
So what do you need from the federal government to help you get to this vaccine faster?
Well, money is always needed, right? So as President Obama requested about $1.9 billion back in February, and the Senate actually approved a $1.1 billion Zika bill. But unfortunately, they got stuck in the House. Congress, is in recess now for the summer. So people like Senator Blumenthal are really, asking for Congress to reconvene now that we have those 22 local cases of, mosquito, most likely to mosquito transmission in Florida. So that money is desperately needed. What the National Institutes of Health, which is the major, federal funding for biomedical research here in the United States, has done is cannibalize some of, the Ebola funds and transfer that to the, so that people can, start doing some of the Zika work. But that is obviously not enough. Money is needed not only for development of vaccines, but also, better diagnostics, mosquito control measures, and so on, and also to just understand the basic biology of the virus. There's a lot that needs to be, that still needs to be learned, the pathogenesis, how the virus, causes disease, and how, it actually leads to microcephaly.
So you received, recently got news, I think it was yesterday, that you received this $400,000 grant from the National Institute of Health. How will you use that grant towards the work?
Yeah, so that is not a lot of money. It was about $410,000, but it is what NIH is able to afford right now. I believe, I'm probably one of the first to receive, funding from NIH specifically for a Zika vaccine. That money will be crucial because, we can develop vaccine candidates relatively quickly. But to do the initial testing, usually in small animal models, models that, by the way, need to, to be better developed, that there was no such a thing as an animal model for Zika before. So to do those studies and to proceed then into, larger animal models and then, essentially into human clinical trials, that takes a lot of money and effort. Money is needed not only to do those things, money also, would help to expedite the process. So that's what is needed.
Can you talk about the urgency as a researcher? Because you mentioned Ebola and how the amount of money the feds are giving towards research and development of a vaccine, preventative efforts towards Ebola, is now being transferred over to deal with Zika. But when Zika is no longer in the news, do you worry that, the work that you're doing is going to be sidelined by something else?
Certainly, because that's exactly what's happening in the Ebola field. You know, all of that effort, you know, may not lead to something if, you know, if that money suddenly disappears. That may be the case with Zika. And so we are always, essentially, we'll be catching up all the time, you know, that we have an outbreak such as, you know, the Ebola and the Zika outbreak. So we need to have a better system to deal with this. We need to not able to just, you know, essentially catching up to these things. We really need to have a system in place so we can react very quickly. And by the way, the reaction here, particularly in the U.S., was very slow, at least to my standards. It took a little bit of time for the CDC and NIH to, you know, make the link between Zika and microcephaly official. During that time, you know, you know, funding did not become available. A lot of research that could have been done, you know, was not necessarily done. Although I have to say that the scientists in the U.S. have been doing a great, great job. They have been, we know, essentially with no money, we know a lot more now, you know, than we knew just, you know, 6 months ago. We really know a lot more. So, but, you know, the money would have been very helpful.
So at the process where you are now, if you were to get this the amount of money that you need, you know, how long would it take to develop a Zika vaccine?
Yes, that's the
million dollar question.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, we do have two vaccines now. There are in human clinical trials. These are two DNA vaccines, one developed by the NIH and one developed by Inovio. So those phase one clinical trials are starting right now. Those types of vaccines, though, are usually the ones that work very well in small animal models like mice. They don't translate very well into humans. So, you know, there is still a need to bring into the pipeline a number of other different vaccines for us to really test their efficacy and later on safety, which will be, you know, a big issue as well. So the prediction of how long it's going to take, you know, for a Zika vaccine to be approved by the FDA is a hard one. I mean, here we are, you know, in 2016, and we still don't have an approved Ebola vaccine. Mm. So, you know, we have been very optimistic. NIH has mentioned, you know, perhaps in 2 years we'll have such a vaccine. I tend to be a little bit more skeptical, but, you know, I think it is possible. But it will take a lot of effort and money.
You mentioned you're from Brazil originally, Dr. Verardi. Obviously a personal connection when you look at Brazil and the explosion of Zika there.
Absolutely. And, you know, and because I was watching, you know, I was actually in Brazil last summer during the initial part of the outbreak. People were not concerned. You know, Zika was a disease that or a virus that, you know, causes symptoms only in a fraction of people. And those symptoms, you know, normally not extremely severe. But it wasn't until October when I was back here that I started noticing, you know, a lot of talk about microcephaly in Brazil. And then suddenly, you know, the link was initially made that I became aware of it and very concerned and quite surprised that the rest of the world was not paying attention to that.
But they are now.
They are certainly now. I mean, Zika has become a household name, no question.
We're almost out of time. I want to turn back to Department of Public Health Commissioner Dr. Raul Pino. If residents want more information about, you know, steps that they can take, especially if they're traveling or, again, because this virus can be transmitted sexually, the things they should be looking for if they're not feeling well.
Well, you know, as always, anyone should go to the doctor as soon as they don't feel well. And as the doctor was saying, only one of five people will develop symptoms. So our biggest concern for transmission is for those who don't feel anything and feel all right. You know, they had come from a vacation, they are having fun, they come from some of the areas. So that's why protection is critical. And it's also critical environment modification in the sense that we have to prevent the mosquito from going in our backyards and landfills and those tires and small containers. And I'm pretty sure Ted did talk about that. And that's critical. This is a disease that is going to stay for a while. Different than Ebola, it's a transmission through a vector in place, a vector that we have not been able to control very well in the past and that it's going to be difficult. And probably Ted did talk about this too, is that the mosquito has been very resilient. This mosquito is It's a smart.
I want to thank Dr. Raul Pino, Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Public Health. Also, Dr. Paolo Verardi, Associate Professor at the University of Connecticut. He's a pathologist working to develop a vaccine for the Zika virus. And Dr. Ted Andriotis, Director of the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. When we come back from the break, a look at UK after Brexit. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Britain's recent vote to leave the European Union shocked the world. Now, several weeks on, the future for the UK and Europe is still far from clear. WNPR's business reporter Harriet Jones is from Britain. She recently went back for a vacation to see family. While she was there, she got a close-up look at people's reaction to the Brexit vote, and she joins us now. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm well. I hope you had a happy vacation.
I had a great time, actually. Yes, it was wonderful.
So we're curious what the mood is like in Britain post-Brexit.
You know, it's really different than I thought it would be, because I anticipated I'd be going back and there would be, you know, debates going on and, you know, arguments and people talking about it all the time. Not the least of it. It was very odd. It seems like, you know, there's almost a mood of eerie calm there. People don't really want to talk about it that much. You can kind of prod them and they'll say one or two things, but they're very keen to kind of change the subject. It seems like, you know, that immediate kind of eruption after Brexit has kind of settled down. And now people want to kind of move on a little bit because they're, and I think that's really to do with the fact that they're not sure what's going to happen. It's become very clear that this is not going to be a quick process. Nobody knows what the end game is. No country has ever left the European Union. So it's just a bunch of unknowns. So it was very interesting talking to people. They would say a couple of things, and then they'd say, but what about the U.S. election? What about Donald Trump? Anybody who comes from the U.S. to the U.K., people are so curious about Trump. And in Scotland particularly, I don't know if you remember Donald Trump's foot in mouth that he did right after the Brexit vote in Scotland. He went to one of his golf courses in Scotland and he said, congratulations for taking your country back.
That's right. That was quite the foot in mouth.
Right. When, of course, you know, the majority of Scots had voted to remain. So many people reminded me of that. They would bring up Donald Trump and that particular incident.
I wanted to turn back to something you said earlier about when you brought up or were asking them about Brexit after the vote. You know, they'd say a few things and then they would turn it back on you, knowing that you're an American now, and asking you about Donald Trump. Do they see parallels? You know, people here that are supporting Donald Trump who are sick of the establishment, do they see parallels to what happened with the people who supported Brexit?
You know, I think there are parallels in the sheer disgust with career politicians. You know, that feeling of, okay, Donald Trump is an outsider, and that's why many people, you know, feel positive towards and want to vote for him. They think he's, you know, different than your regular politician. There is an absolute disgust for politicians over in the UK right now. There's a feeling both among people who voted to leave and those who voted to remain that the politicians have just got them into a massive mess. I was in London and we were on a bus going past, literally past the Houses of Parliament, on that road past Westminster, and the bus driver just dripping with contempt. You know, all the decisions that are made in there are just nonsense. You know, just couldn't have been more disgusted with the politicians. And there's that kind of feeling that that's the feeling amongst a lot of people, even people who voted to leave. You know, you would think they would be happy, right? You'd think they got what they wanted. But they've seen all of those kind of concrete, clear promises that they were given kind of evaporate. You know, they were told, okay, we're going to have control over our borders. We're going to be able to control immigration. We're going to be able to take that money that we spend on the EU and spend it now on our National Health Service. All of those things have kind of evaporated now, and we're left with this uncertainty. And many of the people who made those promises have also left the scene. So Nigel Farage, the head of UKIP, has left. Boris Johnson has made a very weird kind of career move. So he, you know, he could have been the prime minister. I think many people who voted leave were expecting he would be the next prime minister to succeed David Cameron. That didn't happen because of a fight between people in the leave camp. He's now the foreign secretary, which even people who are supporters of Boris Johnson think is kind of a bizarre turn of events, because a less diplomatic person you can't really imagine.
Something that struck a lot of us about the whole Brexit vote is just that nationalistic feeling. So how are immigrants feeling about the Brexit vote?
Yes, immigrants are very much in evidence in the UK, and that's happened more and more. I've been in the States for 15 years now, and I've tried to go back most years, most summers, to see family. And more you find, especially low-wage, temporary type jobs are being filled by immigrants, many from Eastern Europe. Spoke to a lot of them, and, you know, to a person, they told me, this vote has made me feel unwelcome in this country. You know, and that was independent of whether their status would change. I actually met Americans in the UK who obviously won't, their status will not be affected by this. They said, this vote made me feel like I'm not welcome in Britain. And that was what people said, you know, throughout.
Did that feel funny to you? Having, you know, obviously roots there, and like you said, you traveled there often to see that people are starting to feel like they're not welcome.
Yes, it was kind of sad to see because, you know, there are many parts of the UK that are very multicultural and that benefit a lot from being multicultural. And you met people, like I met a Croatian guy who was working. He was just finishing a degree at Edinburgh University. He said, I'm 3 weeks away from finishing my degree. And he was working also in a hostel, you know, to get money to get through his degree. And he said, I'm leaving. I'm done. I'm gone. You know, he said it was partly to do with the Scottish weather, which is not the best. But he said, you know, why would I stay and make a life here when a couple of years from now I might not be able to be here and they might kick me out? So that was kind of sad to see. But there was, I mean, in some ways there was also a division of opinion among immigrants. I know one woman who is the daughter of Italian immigrants. So her parents came in the 60s, even before the European Union. She was born in the UK, but she has very close ties with Italy. She travels back. She speaks Italian. She voted to leave, which I thought was very interesting, you know, because she said it was an immigration issue to her. She said, yes, we need immigrants. Immigrants are very important, but we need to have control. We need to know who's coming in. We need people with skills and we, you know, people who are not a security threat.
You know, why should Americans keep their eye on this? Why should they be following what's happening in the United Kingdom?
Well, I think it's going to have a big effect on the future of the whole of Europe. So Europe obviously is a key ally, key trading partner of the U.S. What happens in Europe, we've seen it already with things like the refugee crisis and the banking crisis in Europe. It has a huge effect over here. So, you know, I think it definitely is something that's worth people keeping their eye on. And, you know, you're already starting to see economic effects. You know, whether it's actually Brexit or whether it's just the uncertainty that nobody knows what's going to happen, you're seeing house prices stagnate. You're seeing companies slow down hiring. I was talking to people who work for international companies there, so companies who might be headquartered in the U.S. but have employees in the U.K. And they're saying, you know, our company is basically in a state of freeze right now, just waiting to see what will happen. They aren't making decisions about where to site operations or who to hire or where to do things because they really don't know what's going to happen.
Has the pound continued to slide against the dollar? Has
it's
there been a
down pretty low. I haven't looked at it in the last few days. But yes, I felt unusually rich over there.
Speaking of which, one positive from Brexit, Reuters is reporting that, you know, a lot of tourists are heading over to the United Kingdom, visitors from Hong Kong, the U.S. and Canada.
Yes, I mean, it's certainly true. I mean, I was there in peak season. So, you know, there's always a lot of people in London in July. And also, you know, in Edinburgh, they're just gearing up for the international festival. So it's always busy. But it did seem like there was many people. Some people were taking advantage of, you know, that the low pound and feeling like they can come over and have a relatively cheap holiday in the UK. But also there were people who said other people they knew had stayed away because of security concerns. Because, you know, we had seen, even while I was there, there were a couple of terrorist incidents on the continent. And then just after I left, there was an incident in London, a stabbing in London. So people, you know, I mean, there's kind of the feeling that, okay, great, you know, it's a cheaper place to go now. But people are concerned about those security risks.
It sounds like you did a lot of reporting, even though you're on vacation.
Well, kind of, you know.
And will we be hearing some reports from you in the coming weeks, again, to look at how Connecticut companies who export, how they'll be impacted by further by the Brexit vote?
Yes, because, of course, you know, the UK is a big trading partner, especially of our aerospace companies. It's very, very important. We just recently this summer saw the air show go on in Europe. That's, you know, hugely important to Connecticut companies. So, again, their problem right now is that low pound because they're trying to export. They're trying to have people in Britain buy their goods. You know, their goods are much more expensive for people in Britain now. So, you know, that's the immediate effect of Brexit for those companies. But in the longer term, it's not so clear, again, what's going to happen, how it's going to change that trading relationship.
All right. WNPR's Harriet Jones, thanks again for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. WNPR's executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Digital editor is Heather Brandon. You can continue the conversation on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.